Denise DeHummel is the author of Ka-Ching, a selection of the Pitt Poetry Series. And today we're going to talk about that book and whatever else comes up. The poet Edward Field wrote about DeHummel, "More than any other poet I know, Denise DeHummel, for all the witty, polished surface of her poems, communicates the ache of human existence." And I think this is a perfect way to describe her work. It takes a poet to describe a poet. This book, Ka-Ching, which in itself is just fun to say, Ka-Ching. I would recommend buying the book just so you can say, I read Ka-Ching. But it really is, quite frankly, it's a very painful book. There's a certain poem that's come to mind in the Play Money section where the speaker of the poem loses her jacket in a movie theater. And believe it or not, it's painful. It's a painful poem. And throughout all the humor, you kind of feel the stab at not having a lot. Coming from working class background, being I don't even want to say a poor poet, but just coming from that background and having living within a culture that encourages material wealth. But I had to ask myself, how could I feel so much for someone who lost a jacket? And as I read her poems, as I read Ka-Ching, I think this is the kind of poetry I admire. We're very happy to have you on the show. Thank you, Denise, for showing up.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's talk about Ka-Ching.
Okay.
How do you feel about this book vis-a-vis all your other books?
Well, I think this book, for me, sometimes I write in series. You know, I know what the book's going to be eventually, and sometimes I don't. And then I just write for a couple of years and then try to look back to see what I was doing. And it didn't occur to me that I was writing so much about money or that kept coming up over and over and over, even though I wrote those prose poems that are actually shaped like dollar bills. It still didn't sort of occur to me. So then when I looked at the work I'd been writing for the past couple of years, that was the one thing. I was like, this work isn't connecting at all. It's all over the place. But then I realized it had this currency, if you will, through it of cash, money, and consumerism, and winning and losing, too. I mean, this whole idea of the word Ka-Ching can mean a windfall, like at a slot machine, Ka-Ching, but it can also mean putting out a lot of money. I just got my Visa bill, Ka-Ching. I mean, it can be both. You know, it can be both. And I was sort of interested in sort of the luck of why certain people are born rich, why certain people are born poor, you know, just a whole lottery of life, if you will.
That first section you referred to, it's called Play Money. You're referring to that. And these are prose poems that are fit inside of a dollar bill. In fact, you have to turn the book sideways in order to read them. What I really like about these pieces is that they're so loose in the sense that the language just seems to be able to go anywhere, yet they're so contained inside these dollar bills and really kind of so precise in their language. And I think that's a really nice tension about this book, is it seems so loose, like it could do anything, yet at the same time it seems so focused. Is that something you had to work on hard?
Actually, in a way it was, because I was sort of thinking of that American dream, like, you can do anything, you go, girl, but you really can't. I mean, yes, in theory, I suppose, but, you know, the constraints of where we're born, I mean, it is sort of this, the American dream. I mean, I guess you know, you look at someone, yes, like one out of a million people can, but it's all luck and weirdness in a way as well. You know, yes, it is your self-determination and your chutzpah and all that, but it's also, you know, there's a lot of blocks along the way. So I really found these at a thrift store, these Play Money, and they're $100,000 bills each. And so I wrote the poem. They really exist I actually wrote them on the back of the, I put them in my printer sideways, do you know what I mean? So they actually occur. And it was so interesting to me because it really was, as you say, you know, it can go anywhere, but not really, because I was determined to make all those poems the same exact size, the same exact length, the same exact, you know, I would have to put in an adjective to make it go the last line all the way. You know, you change one word and everything would change. So it was really fun to do. It was started out as a visual poetry project. And I was so happy that Pitt was able to include it in the book as I wanted it to. I mean, they could just be in prose blocks too, but I was really happy. The designer was very patient with me and trying to recreate them.
Well, we're talking to Denise DeHummel, author of Ka-Ching. I wish you could see these poems in the first section called Money Talk, and they're all fit inside these dollar-shaped bills, or in this case, $100,000-shaped bills. But all of them are just filled to capacity. They can go no more. They can't move anymore. Yet at the same time, there's such a looseness of the language, as if you remind me of a poet like Arthur Z, who can just go from one thing to another without anything other than poetic logic. Yet at the same time, they're so, so precise. And yet it also reminds me of the eBay sonnets. And I think in the section two, you have this poem called eBay Sonnets. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, this is a crown of sonnets. And I guess more than my other books, I was really interested in form. I have been doing a lot of free verse. That's sort of how I grew up, is with free verse. And I would write one or two sonnets. I think I did write a sonnet in grad school because I had to, but I was never that interested. And only later in life was I, this is kind of fun, you know, and I could approach it without dread and sort of playfulness. And so, yeah, they're sonnets, connected sonnets, and they're called eBay sonnets. And again, they're about making the wrong choices or seemingly making the wrong choices financially and losing money and those kind of things. I mean, I think it's maybe sort of a middle age crisis, things you don't think about until you hit a certain age, and then you think, oh my God, how am I going to retire and live? I don't have enough money. And I think artists especially tend to just seize the day, if you will, you know, carpe diem, and don't project that sort of long-term money, because we've always been taken care of by our art sustains us. But then at some point, I guess I was trying to reconcile poetry and commerce.
Well, we're very fortunate as writers. We have jobs at universities, but if we didn't have those jobs, we would have no commission from the state, as it were, if you were to translate us to historical times when an artist had to be commissioned by the state or by the king or by the queen or something.
Mm-hmm.
We have these jobs, but if you don't, how do you make money? And I really love the imagination of this sonnet, eBay sonnets, or this collection of sonnets, and how far a writer can go in order to try to make a little bit of money, and in this case, selling her poems on eBay, in a sense.
It is sort of a good idea. I probably should have just did it rather than do the poem.
Well, it makes sense. You sell the speaker of the poem selling these volumes of writers on eBay and becomes an eBay a literary expert, in a sense. It almost reminds me of this poet that I knew who's still out there, and she sometimes does readings, and she offers people to write. She'll write a poem for you for $10.
Wow, that's so great. Here in Miami, we're doing we have something called the Miami Poetry Collective, and it's made up of graduate students, and they go to art shows or whatever, and I think their poems are only $1, but they're written right on the spot on typewriters. So, will you write a poem for my cat? Will you write a poem for my husband? And I just do it, and it's hilarious.
Oh, that's a wonderful way to raise money at a university. It's almost like a literary kissing booth.
It's very much like a kissing booth, very much.
What about the speaker of the poem wanting to write novels? Your prose is so beautiful. Your language is incredible. But have you ever tried to write fiction or memoir?
I've written two novels that never were published.
Oh, so it's true.
Actually, three. Yeah, I guess this is really funny, but in the 80s, I had, it's again, that like luck and that element of what are you going to do? And I remember I wrote a first novel, and I had an agent in New York. This is great. They're going to bid for it. You know the story ends badly because you lose the poem. But at one point, it was supposed to be bid on. And that was the stock market crashed. Like not as bad as this.
That's another sad story.
And it was so weird. And then I was like, well, that's okay. Someone will want it. And it was like poison. It, like even university presses were like, no. And I mean, it was just this very bizarre. I just feel like my life's been connected to that for some reason. and good things too. Like I've had really lucky breaks. Also, so I hoped before I die, I'm knocking on wood, I hope I write a novel or a memoir or something, because I do have the impulse to do it, but I've never been successful at it. I'm not good with plot. I mean, I can do the other stuff, but then, I don't know, it just falls apart, I guess, or drags on.
Well, have you ever thought about going back into those novels and revising them?
I have, and I think I will. I actually think I will. I just had to get, for me, it was like, with such a bad experience, I thought, oh, I'm going to get a little distance. But I guess 25 years is enough for since.
We're talking about the book Ka-Ching by Denise Duhamel, which is a book of poems. There's a lot of prose poems in there, too. The book is tied together nicely with the poem 9/11, 2003. It's a chilling poem about an accident. In fact, I think the first line begins with the speaker of the phone getting a phone call from her sister and says, there's been an accident. This ties the poem together beautifully. I mean, not just thematically, but in imagistically and in so many ways. Can you tell us a little bit about the accident and where the source of this came from?
Sure. I mean, it came, unfortunately, from real life.
My
My parents did suffer in September 10th, 2003. They took one of those bus trips. They live in New England, and in Rhode Island, and they took a bus trip to Atlantic City. And they were on an escalator, one of those giant escalators that goes for two floors, and the thing malfunctioned, and all these people toppled backwards. And my mother, both of my parents were hurt terribly, and my mother especially was disfigured. I mean, it was this horrible, completely horrible thing. And my mom was in surgery overnight, so no one called, no doctor called. And my dad was in the same hospital, but they were in different units. Because my dad had suffered a heart attack, and so he was on the heart unit, and my mother had been physically hurt, so she was on a different unit. And it was just this, I mean, it was brutal and horrible. And because it happened in a casino, it was even worse somehow, because it was connected to this, like, sleaziness, you know what I mean? It was really awful. It was really awful. So I didn't, again, so I think I'm writing about my parents, and I was very interested in, like, the way their bodies had suffered and what happened to them that was so horrific and, you know, quote-unquote a freak accident. And I thought I was writing about what it was like to take care of parents who had suffered. But then when I realized that it was took place in a casino and that there was this really sleazy lawsuit and, you know, it was just, oh, it was awful. It made it worse, you know?
Yeah, you know, I always talk to my fiction students. I'm a fiction writer. I love poetry, but I'm a fiction writer. And
I know, yep.
I always tell my students about in every story there seems to be, whether consciously or not, this Elif moment, this moment in the story where there's so much energy that it somehow feeds into every other aspect of the story and gives shape to landscape and image and language and all this stuff. And this particular poem, 9/11, 2003, seems to be the Elif moment of this book. It just holds it together in really kind of an amazing way. And it's for that reason that I thought that this book must have started with that. But the fact that it fits in is just an amazing, I guess it was an amazing discovery for you?
It really was, because I really thought, well, I didn't know what to do with those poems because they were so dark. I mean, they don't really have much humor in them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I try.
Oh, and they're hard to read. They're hard to read. The description of the mother, her hair, and just, you know, people being pulled into that escalator was just, man, it was brutal.
It's awful. It's really awful. I mean, it was so awful. And I think it kind of goes to, well, of course, luck, because it's in a casino, but also the way we, like, herd people along on these escalators. And when I did all this research about escalators because it's not even that uncommon for them to malfunction. And the reason we use escalators is because it's a lot cheaper and you can move people faster than elevators. But elevators, ironically, are much, much safer. I mean, yes, you can have an elevator accident, but not often.
You have a statistic in the book about the accident rate. Can you tell us about that between escalators and elevators?
Well, I was, you know, there was this lawsuit against the casino, which ended not very well for my parents, but it was like one of those instances of, like, the big guy is always winning. So I had done all this research, and I was working with the lawyer, was very good. I mean, it wasn't really his fault. Yeah, he was saying that, you know, we just really use escalators because people are cheap, and that at every escalator there's supposed to be someone by law standing there to press there's an emergency button, and no one ever does it because it's cheaper just to let people fall and have lawsuits.
What do you think about the question, are you a political poet? How do you feel about that question?
I think I am a political poet, and I'm not afraid of a label at all. I know that a lot of times, I've tried to ask this of other poets, and they always say no. They're like,
or they get
mad
at the question.
Yeah, like, what do you mean? But I really feel like, I mean, I don't mind the label at all, and I do feel like I am a political poet, and I feel like it's my only way to fight back. I mean, the frustration of it all is, it's too much. I mean, it's really too much, and so I think for me, poetry is a way to sort of at least address it and at least humanize, maybe put a human face on what happens when corporations act so irresponsibly. I mean, we know it in theory. We know it. I mean, we read it, but then to actually have it, to put faces on it, I think makes it interesting, you know, and even more horrifying.
You have a very working class perspective when it comes to the economy, when it comes to commerce. And that further expresses this, I don't know, I hate to reduce it to a cliche, but rage against the culture, rage against the corporations. I don't know.
No, I definitely feel that rage. And I feel like for me, I mean, to write poetry or for, I mean, it's at least something, I guess. And I think as a younger poet, maybe I was more afraid of my rage. It's not becoming, and especially for women poets, you know, like, oh, gee, that's too bad. You know, it's really the tone. But I think in a lot of us, a lot of people in general feel this rage. And I think it's, I mean, you have to subvert it, of course. You can't just yell it.
Yeah, in fact,
but,
I almost don't like to call it rage, because when I read your poems, I don't think of rage. I think of humor and pain and other words come to mind. Yet at the same time, there is that frustration of, you know, being working class. And also, you seem to respond a lot to images of women that fits into your poem. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I've always felt this way. I mean, I remember at the beginning I would write, like, a sex poem or something, and people would be, that's erotica, and I'm like, no, it's not erotica. It's a woman. I mean, I think women in our culture, I know I can't speak for all women, but I think a lot of us feel like objects,
right,
you know,
right.
I mean, or in general are objectified, like, oh, what does she look like, you know what I mean? And, you know, like all the commodification of women and to sell products, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I know women are subjects, and so I want to write poems in which women are the subjects of the poems rather than ornamentation or objects, if that makes sense. So that's like been a lifelong project. Like, I remember thinking consciously I wanted to do that. I, even though I'm a woman, I can still fall into cliches about women or stereotypes. I mean, I look at the same media that men look at, and you know what I mean? It's like it's easy for me to do too. So I mean, I know I probably have done it, but I try really hard not to.
What are you working on now?
Well, I have a book coming out.
I figured you might.
It's called Blowout, and it's going to come out in March of 2013. And it's interesting because Blowout, the title Blowout, is working similarly to the way Ka-Ching is, because Blowout can be a really big, fun party, or it can also be like your tire blowing out, you know, so it can be something malfunctioning. So this, unfortunately, because of my life experiences, it's going to be about the end of a marriage and relationships and, stuff, you know, I know, but it's going to be fun. I tried to make it sort of funny as well.
I
tried to make it the opposite of Eat, Love, Pray, a book that I hate so much I can't even tell you.
Did you actually
read
it?
It's like a working class. Well, yeah, because when I read like half and then hurled it across the room.
Yeah.
But it was,
that's valuable.
You know, when I went through a divorce, and I remember someone said, oh, read this, it'll make you feel better. And about a super rich person who is, she's getting divorced, so she goes around the world to find herself. And I was like, you've got to be kidding. It was like about the money thing, so it didn't work out. So this is sort of a working class version of it.
Oh, well,
when you can't travel the world.
and do you in any way in the book evoke that in an ironic sort of way? Or that's
wonderful. I try. It's funny. You know, it's very sad and horrible, but it's also financial and it's awful.
Right. What can you do to seek that experience if you don't have enough money even to leave town or to go to a restaurant?
Oh, my goodness. But it was funny. But I think that was, again, it's that pop culture of that everyone suffers the same way. And we really don't, you know? It's like, I mean, yes, we all have human emotions, no matter how rich or how poor, but, you know, the way that we deal with things sometimes can be influenced by our wallets, I think.
I'd hate for people to get the wrong impression about your poetry based on this interview, because it's not, it's so funny. I laughed aloud so many times reading Ka-Ching, and I imagine this other one is going to be pretty funny too. And so even though you do bring up these, very organically bring up these important issues, you don't seem to be didactic in any way. I was wondering if you would be kind enough to read a poem for us, either something from Ka-Ching. One of the things that you do in the book a lot, which I think shows your sense of humor, is you play with forms. You don't take them too seriously, but you kind of play with them a little bit. And I'm thinking in particular of two poems, Anagram America, which has the word America in every line, but mixed up in such a way that they become other words like A, Crime, A, Camera, I, Acme, Ira, but they all end in America. And it's really kind of an interesting play with form. It's almost as if the form itself is not sacred and needs to be made fun of a bit. We have this segment on Words on a Wire called Poem of the Day, and I was hoping you would be able to read one of those poems where you kind of have fun with the form. And I'm thinking particularly of Delta Flight 659, which is a poem that you dedicated to Sean Penn, the actor. And it's really interesting because even though you lose track of it, because the poem is, the language is just so, the rhythm and the language work so effectively, you kind of lose track of it. But every single line ends with the word pen. How did this one come about?
Well, actually, I'm a sort of a nervous flyer. And I was writing, I had this idea
with
for
the pen?
A poem. Yeah, so I actually wrote a lot of this on the plane. And I thought, I would love to write a Sestina. And then I went to write a Sestina, and I thought, I have no idea the order of the words. You know what I mean? Because in a traditional Sestina, there's six end words that permeate all through the poem. And I didn't have a Sestina with me, and I thought, oh, I could just use the same word over and over and over and be really blunt. So I chose the word pen because I was thinking about this Sean Penn incident, and he was in a magazine I was reading. I was reading one of those trashy magazines. And then also, you know, of course, Penn, the writer. So yeah, every single N word has pen embedded in its word.
And so you really penned the first draft of this on a plane.
I did.
Excellent. Then let's hear Delta Flight 659. We're going to go ahead and turn it over to you for Poem of the Week. We welcome Denise DeHommel.
Thank you. Delta Flight 659 to Sean Penn. I'm writing this on a plane, Sean Penn, with my black Pilot Razor ballpoint pen. Ever since 9/11, I'm a nervous flyer. I leave my Pentium processor in Florida so TSA can't x-ray my stanzas penetrate my persona. Maybe this should be an iambic pentameter rather than this mock Sestina, each line ending in a pen variant. I convinced myself the ticket to Baghdad was too expensive. I contemplated going as a human shield. I read in open mouth shock that your trip there was a $56,000 expenditure. Is that true? I watched you on Larry King Live, his suspenders and tie, your open collar. You saw the war's impending mess. My husband gambled on my penumbra of doubt. So you station yourself at a food silo in Iraq. What happens to me if you get blown up? He begged me to stay home, be his Penelope. I sit alone in coach, but last night I sat with four poets, depending on one another as readers in a Pittsburgh cafe. I tried to be your pen pal in 1987, not because of your pensive bad boy looks, but because of a poem you penned that appeared in an issue of Frank. I still see the poet in you, Sean Penn. You probably think fans like me are your penance for your popularity, your star bulging into a pentagon filled with witchy wannabes and penniless poets who waddle towards your icy peninsula of glamour like so many menacing penguins. But honest, I come in peace, Sean Penn, writing on my plane ride home. I want no part of your penthouse or the snowy slopes of your Aspen. I won't stalk you like the swirling grime cloud over Pigpen. I have no script or stupendous novel I want you to option. I even like your wife, Robin Wright Penn. I only want to keep myself busy on this flight to tell you of four penny loafered poets in Pennsylvania who last night, chomping on primavera, penne, pasta, pondered poetry, celebrity, erot, the penitentiary of free speech, and how I reminded everyone that Sean Penn once wrote a poem. I peer out the window, caress my lucky pendant. Look, Sean Penn, the clouds drawn with charcoal pencils. The sky is opening like a child's first stab at penmanship. The sun begins to ripen orange, then deepen.
Delta Flight 659 from Kaching by Denise DeHummel. Thank you for sharing that poem with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.